From KUAZ, Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, the skill and science of making guitars is alive and well in South Phoenix, and Kimberly Kraft will introduce us to the artisans at the Roberto Venn School of Luthieri. Robert Rappaport interviews a Tucson legend, kindly lovable TV horror host Dr. Scar, also known as broadcasting pioneer Jack Jacobson, about scaring a generation of kids silly. We'll visit a Tucson company that specializes in making treats from desert fruit when Luis Carrion takes us to Sherry's Desert Harvest. And hear the music made by one of artist Glenn Wyant's homemade instruments. He'll talk to us about using sound across borders of all kinds. That's coming up next, right here on Arizona Spotlight. The word lute can be used to describe almost any stringed instrument with a neck and a resonating body. Since ancient times, the lute has evolved into many different forms, eventually becoming the modern guitar, which finds itself central to music styles as diverse as blues, flamenco, and heavy metal. For some players, only the best, handmade instruments will do. We'll find out more about the art of guitar making, known as luthieri, as we travel to South Phoenix with Kimberly Kraft for our story.
In the late 1800s, when the piano became the parlor and concert favorite, Spaniards resisted, favoring the instrument that originated in their homeland, the guitar. Yet the guitar enjoyed a lowly status, usually in the hands of gypsies or peasants and those who played for loose change in bars.
I play guitar all my life. I've been through a lot of ups and downs, but guitar has always been there in my life.
Steve Ryan seems to embody the itinerant history of guitarists. His personal story resonates of current events and a deep longing for simpler times.
Recently, I was in Iraq, and I decided there was just too much destruction going on, too many things that I didn't like that I was taking part in. And I said, maybe as a catharsis, I decided, I'm going to do something creative. So
Ryan made his life change at the Roberto Venn School of Luthieri in Phoenix, where students marry the creative and the constructive elements of guitar building. In business since 1977, the school has populated circles of production and handmade fabrication of instruments that end up in the hands of the world's most influential musicians and hobbyists.
Well, I was going to Trinity College to do physics and electrical engineering, and it didn't interest me until I could apply it to my guitar work. And so I found this school and I figured it'd be a perfect way to kind of meld my academics with something that really interests me. So
students come from all over the world, yet they share the same culture, a passion for the guitar, and most are players as well. Steve Melendi hails from New Hampshire. As a college student, he became disenchanted with his life on paper and transferred to the Roberto Venn School, where he's using his hands to understand the bookwork.
Once I took the physics course and could look at how waves worked, how electromagnetism and all different things applied to the guitar, something sparked and I just loved it, and then knew that I had to get my hands on this stuff and doing it myself.
Known as the King Tut of the shop, John Reuter feels flattered that students have dubbed his school the Harvard of guitar making. His path presages those of many of his students. With a degree in manufacturing and engineering technology from Arizona State University, he worked briefly as a machinist until his company went belly up. He responded by enrolling as a student at Roberto Venn and found he had a knack for building guitars. He has since become a driving force at developing the curriculum and vision for the school.
I've just been learning as much as I can, trying to network with as many builders and other, the industry. What do you want me to be teaching? What are your needs so that our product, the student, is going to fall right into what you want them to be doing?
The grounds sprawl across several Quonset huts in South Phoenix, where in 5 months' time, students build one acoustic and one electric guitar and learn the basics of repair and construction. That attention to detail has resulted in student placement throughout the guitar manufacturing industry. The school has Title 41 accreditation, which enables it to offer students financial aid. Reuter refers to his students as sheep, his instructors as shepherds, and has retired from the shop to drive the flock to greener pastures.
I would rather focus on the fundamentals and make sure that they can get into the business being really good at the stuff that's extremely common and sort of work out towards the fringe, rather than trying to teach them a little bit about way too many things so that they're still sort of unclear on the basics.
The basics involve becoming proficient with tools, a skill that Steve Ryan never acquired as a desk jockey. Eventually, he intends to establish his own business and pass his knowledge on to his sons.
I have four sons, and I want to do something that can teach them to have freedom. They aren't going to be tied to a desk. They aren't going to be tied to an employer. They're going to be able to be their own bosses.
In a society that often considers the arts as supplemental to industry, the business of music making crosses that divide. Melendi knows he will eventually complete an academic degree and use it to make the art soar.
It really depends on which route I want to go. I'm kind of torn because I have some electrical engineering background, so I'm thinking about maybe going into the guitar electronics, maybe acoustic amplification systems. But then at the same time, there are different bracing patterns. There's all sorts of different stuff I can do with the actual acoustic instrument itself.
Perhaps the symbol of the creative practitioner is Reuter, a deadhead of the first water who developed his trademark Jerrycaster, which defies simple mechanical explanation. A shop accident claimed most of the fingers on his fret-playing hand, but he and Roberto Venn rock on. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Kimberly Kraft.
Now, let's turn the clock back about 40 years to the age of Saturday night horror movies in Tucson. Back to when the scary movie host with the most was kindly, lovable Dr. Scar. The character of Dr. Scar was created by broadcasting pioneer Jack Jacobson, who will reminisce next with the not-so-scary Robert Rappaport.
Good evening, friends. Welcome once again to Big Nine Killer. This is your host, kindly lovable Dr. Star. Kindly lovable indeed.
Jack Jacobson, a.k.a. Dr. Scar, welcome. What's the best way to describe what he looked like?
Well, Dr. Scar was kind of an old, miserable-looking guy with wild white hair, teeth missing, a patch, an eye patch, a big flat nose. It was all makeup. And he spoke kind of like this.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And welcome to Big Nine Chiller. This is your host, kindly lovable Dr. Scar. And that's what he was, that kind of a character. And we did the openings to horror movies and the closes. And we did little playlet kind of things, little sketches.
What was Dr. Scar's purpose? Just being the interstitial stuff, or did you sell things?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was it became a big cult figure, Dr. Scar did, in the 60s and the early 70s. So I was on the air for about 9 years. And, of course, we did a lot of stuff with Dr. Scar. I mean, he was at Old Tucson. I worked with the Addams Family. That's the kind of a character it was. So we used him in promos. We used him a lot of ways. But they could sell him. He was a big, as I say, a big cult hero. And especially with the U of A, the students here loved it. They called me and they wanted to be on the show and be characters on the show all the time.
Back in those days, 40 years ago, was this all live, or did you have ways to put on film?
Absolutely live. And remember, in those days, it was black and white. We had no special effects, and we had to make up our special effects as we went along. And I have some tapes that we managed to save that shows one of the special effects where Dr. Scar is singing and dancing with Dr. Scar. So that was something that was unheard of in those days. But the engineers managed to pull that off, and it was pretty good.
You ready? A one, a two, a me, and my shadow. Take it. Strolling down the avenue. And here we go. Me and my shadow floating down the
Now, what about the movies themselves? Were these part of a syndication packages for other parts of the country?
I was actually program director at KGON at that time and promotion manager. And so it was my job to buy the film packages and the syndicated stuff. And so that's another thing I had control over was were the movies that we could run, especially the chiller movies. So we ran The Old Mummy and a lot of – I just bought any horror films I could find, and we used them that night. Some of them were terrible. Some were very good, you know, but it was a lot of fun.
Now, on the really bad ones, did you talk it up like they were really good ones?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, everything was great. Everything was terrific. And, of course, that was the fun of the show. It didn't matter.
There you are, friends. We certainly hope you enjoyed our first exciting story. Don't go away. We'll pause for a few moments, and then we shall return with the first act of The Curse of Nostradamus.
Did you used to drive around town in like a hearse type thing?
Yes, yes.
Because I remember that as a kid. Can you describe that? What was your mode of transportation when you did the appearances?
Well, what happened was that I think it was Old Tucson that had the hearse and Bob Shelton there. And I asked him if we could use it. Bob Love and I. Bob was Marshall Kagan. I don't know if you remember the character.
And Uncle Bob.
Sure, Uncle Bob. And so he said, sure, be great. So in the parades, because it was horse-driven, so we'd go to the place and they'd deliver the hearse, the old hearse, and we had a coffin inside and the body. We'd ride up on the top of it, and of course we're the driver, and we did that, and mainly that was it. Just kind of different things like that.
Did kids ever get scared seeing you?
Sure. That was the idea. We kept warning them, you know, well, we didn't do anything really that horrible. We just, you know, did kind of screaming kind of things where the kids would jump and holler and hide their heads. And but they loved it. They loved it. So and in that way, it became a kid show, too, which really I couldn't believe it. You know, I thought it was for adults. I mean, that's how I had planned it.
Now, what's left, in today's world, what's left of the Dr. Scar? Was a lot of this live and not recorded, or the tapes deteriorate over the years?
Well, what happened was one of the engineers had foresight, and he saved a couple of the 2-inch, which was a real big tape in those days. That's what we used in the early days. And so we had a bunch of reels of that. And a lot of this, it just fell apart. As he was dubbing it, the tape just fell apart, just disintegrated. So we did manage to get a couple of reels of a couple of the sketches.
But by and large, it's mostly gone.
It's mostly gone, yeah.
And when was the last time you donned the Dr. Scar makeup?
Oh, it was a long time. It was actually when I took it off and stopped doing it, that was the last time in the 70s.
How often does somebody mention Dr. Scar to you these days?
At least 3-4 times a week, I will get somebody who remembers the Dr. Scar. It's very gratifying.
Jack Jacobson and Dr. Scar, thank you both for joining us.
Wait a minute. Let's close this off right. Good evening, friends. We hope you enjoyed Big Nine Chiller. Be sure to join us again next Saturday night when we present another chilling tale of terror. Until then, good night and pleasant dreams. And for Arizona Spotlight, I'm Dr. Scar. See you later, friends.
We'll have more Arizona Spotlight right after this break.
Thank you.
Sherry's Desert Harvest is a homegrown Tucson company that specializes in making candy, preserves, and other edible products out of locally grown fruit. The humble prickly pear cactus has become an important ingredient in many of Sherry's unique delicacies. Next, Luis Carrion pays a visit to the small operation, hidden away in an industrial area off Keno Parkway in central Tucson.
The nutritional value of it is so high that actually it's an anti-inflammatory.
You may have heard about the many studies that have identified the prickly pear cactus as a source of many healing benefits.
Wonderful for controlling insulin use. It lowers cholesterol. There's a multitude of wonderful.
Now, as we begin to understand through science the beneficial attributes of these desert plants, Sherry Romanowski has found an increased interest in her preserves, candies, and other products made from the cactus fruit.
This is out of our Arizona deserts, around Tucson, Arizona. We've brought in about 30 tons this year, which is 60,000 pounds, and that will hopefully get us through the year.
When we caught up with Sherry at the small operation in a central Tucson industrial neighborhood, she was busy mixing the ingredients for prickly pear syrup.
We take the fresh pears right out of the desert, and we clean them, and then they're cooked in these very cookers. We've had both cookers going, the big one and the smaller one, and they steam, and then we put them through a press, like a wine press. We just bought a brand new one. Up to now, it's all been by hand and a lot of hand pressing. So now we finally have been able to automate a little bit.
Sherry's Desert Harvest is the business started by Sherry, and it began as a simple operation in her home that was motivated by a desire to use the plants found in her yard, as well as the need to provide healthy alternatives for her young family.
General philosophy in business and what started my business was to produce foods that were all natural. And what prompted me to get into business was just to make foods for my children. So I made my own foods from any kind of vegetable that grew in my yard, any kind of fruit that grew in my yard.
For Sherry, like so many of us who live in the desert, the fruits from the yard include the prickly pear, and it is the cactus fruit that provides the inspiration for the small business year-round.
The circle of work that we do starts in about April, March, April in our deserts, and that's when we have a beautiful profusion of blossoms that come on the prickly pear. And what's beautiful about them is they're beautiful, very lacy, almost lily-like flowers that come on to the prickly pear, and initially they start out a brilliant yellow. The blossom falls off, and then it continues to grow into a bulbous fruit, a rounded bulbous fruit. And it takes many months. It takes until July, August, September before that fruit actually ripens to a stage of getting to that deep, dark magenta color.
The rich color of the fruit is truly impressive, and it becomes even more pronounced when the juice is extracted during the harvest season.
There are over 200 species of prickly pear, but the one that grows naturally out here and in abundance is the Engelmann prickly pear. And it yields this beautiful color. It's high in nutritional values. It's a wonderful product that we've taken advantage of taking it out of the desert. And then after we press it and use it into jelly and marmalades and syrups, etc., then we use the mash and turn it into biscuits for zoo animals, because it's still, the nutritional level is so great and the fiber and the protein is still intact. So the zookeepers have asked us to actually produce it for them.
On the path from the desert to the consumer, the cactus fruit that ends up in Sherry's supply passes through here.
Sherry and I make 500 pounds of candy during the day.
Don Dixon, who retired as an engineer for the railroad, has been working here for 13 years. For him, the job is an alternative to spending his days golfing.
And we also do chocolates, but only with the prickly pear.
The product line has evolved from the initial cactus fruit offerings. However, the main inspiration continues to be the prickly pear. And prickly pear candy dipped in chocolate seemed like a logical progression.
She takes 200 or 300 pounds and stands all day long, and she works at one end of the line.
Oh my God.
And applies the chocolate.
Yes, ma'am. Now, the candy will pass by on this conveyor belt and continue into the next room where the girls will pack it.
The machine is called the Lucille Ball machine because if anyone remembers an episode where she is receiving all these candies coming out of a machine.
Fine, you're doing splendidly. Speed it up a little!
The very first day was a nightmare, but I'm doing better.
The idea of prickly pear cactus might strike people as a novelty at first, and certainly it has a market among tourists, but really Sherry's Desert Harvest is about making a connection with the land, eating local, and creating a sustainable product from the environment. And the humble beginnings of the business can still be seen.
Pretty soon my neighbors knew I could do this. So over they would come in a little red wagon filled with fruits and vegetables from their own yards. And I preserved it for them, sent it back, and then they would give me refried beans and tamales and whatever they did in their own kitchen. So it was a wonderful barter system. That started the philosophy, and I have continued that philosophy in my business.
For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Luis Carrion.
You can visit KUAZ.org for a link to Sherry's website. Her cactus candy and other products are available at local farmers markets, including the 17th Street Market, and can be ordered online as well. We've got the link at KUAZ.org. The sounds you are hearing are produced by our next guest, Glenn Wyant, using a unique musical instrument of his own design, the blue-blue, which was named by his young daughter. Glenn is an artist and musician who lives in Tucson, but his work has taken him on many journeys. Recently, he was involved in a project in Knoxville, Tennessee, that included teaching kids about his found object aesthetic. First thing we should do is probably explain to people what it was that you were playing.
That was called the Blue Blue. It's an instrument of original design that was named by my daughter. What it is basically is a piece of a curtain rod with a large tin can resonator. The tin can has three holes in it where the wires come out. You can change the octaves by manipulating the strings, which are basically guitar wires, guitar strings, which are steel wires, and loops from tape, old loops that the tape was on. Yeah, and you can roll them down, rule them up to get more of a vibration, get more of a drone sound to them. There's all kinds of things you can do.
So we're looking at the blue-blue here on the table in front of us, and I have to ask, Glenn, there are a lot of musical instruments in the world already. Mm-hmm. What is it that inspires you to make your own?
You know, it's empowering, I think, to actually create an instrument of original design, decide what the rules are for playing it, what sounds are pleasing to you as an individual, and then finding ways of using those instruments to communicate with other musicians. But at its heart, I think, is a personal philosophy that I've been sort of developing over the years, where if each person was able to build an instrument of original design and then find a way of communicating with another musician, then it kind of throws out any of the biases of language, gender, race, all those kind of things go out the door, nationality, even your economic status. It doesn't matter. You don't have to have a lot of money to buy an instrument. You can build from what you have. It comes back to my daughter. When she was born, I was playing saxophone. I was playing a tenor sax. I was playing very loud. It would wake her up, basically, in the evenings when she was sleeping. And so I started working with micro sounds, and I wound up developing systems for using contact microphones to play very small sounds that you wouldn't notice normally. Like the work that I did with the Border Project, the Anta Project, that was amplifying sounds that you would not normally hear. So that the microphone is attached to the wall, and you know, you'd see me bowing the wall, but you wouldn't necessarily hear the wall resonating the way it was. But then if you put the headphones on, you could hear what I was working with. And so through my daughter trying to be quiet and let her sleep, I found this whole world of sound that was hidden.
So let's go back and talk about the Anta Project that you referred to a moment ago. This is something that got you a lot of attention.
Well, the idea was it was spring of 2006, and I was trying to come up with a new project. And I've been working with swing sets. I've played bridges. I've played all sorts of, just, you know, like the Snake Bridge, for example. I did a little practice on it. The Snake Bridge does not have good acoustic properties. I've tried playing it. It's very, very solid. But the overpass is like if you go along the Rito River, they're wonderful. The steel girders have really nice sounds to them. And so I was starting to get into these ideas of what could I play that would be significant. And so I started to think about the border, and that was becoming really hot at that time. People were debating from all over the country, and it was resonating with the world. And I was thinking, well, you know, I wonder if it's possible, because it became such a symbol for acrimony and division, if it's possible to sort of change the symbolism of it and how to do that through music. I had no idea what the wall itself would sound like between Nogales, Sonora, and Nogales, Arizona. And so it became a process of really listening with headphones on. I had a contact microphone, which is a lot like a stethoscope, a little metal piece that went into a compression sustained volume pedal that really boosts the sounds hugely. And then that went to a very simple Sony recorder that you'd use for recording like a lecture or something like that. Very basic, I think all told, I had about $100 or so worth of equipment on me. And so what I began doing was finding spots in the wall, such as seams and things like that, that would have interesting sounds. I also used the wire fences. I used water jugs. And I tried to find things that were symbolic of immigration that might resonate with the rest of the country. But at the same time, I wanted to create an ambient work that would be a travel piece that would sort of give you an idea of what it's like to look at the U.S. border from the Mexico side with the helicopters and the spotlights and everything else. And then sort of that migrational coming into the U.S. and then having this open road. There are people who are pro or anti-immigration. This isn't meant to be a statement either direction. It's actually meant to be an awareness piece to have people start questioning to know about what's going on.
Do you think that there's a musician in everybody?
I would say so. Absolutely. Yeah. Through the work that I was doing in Knoxville, we went out to some of the rural Head Start facilities, and the kids brought in all sorts of found objects that they had. And what the idea was, we were going to do some seminars where they would learn how to build instruments. And so we had tin cans and we had water bowls, and we kind of walked through some of the basics of percussion, you know, what would make a good drum, what makes a good... And then they started to come up with instruments that were their own names. You know, like one boy took a water jug, a huge water bottle, cut the end of it off, attached a hose to it, and would blare like these Godzilla kind of sounds into it. And it was, I forget what he called it, but it was like that was his instrument. He invented it. It was his thing. This was his sound. And then there were some girls that were just like wailing away on these cans. And at first they were very aggressive and loud, but then they started listening to each other and slowing down. They got rid of their anxiety. And suddenly we had this orchestra playing instruments that these children had invented. When I say children, I mean like up to 12, 13 years old. And then we decided to come up with a narrative for it. Just like the Anthro Project was a narrative of a migrant's journey into the U.S., we decided to do a summer rainstorm, began with like, you know, very quiet, had some crickets and bullfrogs, and being in the rural area, they did really great with that kind of stuff. And then the rain came, and then the thunder, and really cacophonous type of piece, and then the calm after the storm. And we did this for about 20 minutes, and it was just a really nice piece. And when it was done, you could tell the kids were all on the same level. They knew when the silence was coming. They knew when the crescendos were coming in. And it was all done as a form of communication. It was musical. It was there was really very little verbal communication, and yet they were all telling a story.
You can find links to more from Glenn online at KUAZ.org. That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. Thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio, Arizona Public Media, and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. Most of the music heard on our program, including the theme, was written and performed by Calexico. Podcasts of Arizona Spotlight are available online at KUAZ.org. I'm Mark McLemore.